Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1.
The thinking atheist. It's not a person.
It's a symbol.
An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
Everybody just relax, okay? Just relax. The Thinking Atheist Podcast is not going anywhere. And as long as you will have me, I am not going anywhere. I still love the Thinking Atheist Podcast and community. I love doing what I do. I think it's important work. I hope it's important work. It is not going anywhere, and as far as I can tell, neither am I, okay? But I was ready to stretch, you know, to do something else. And my second podcast, True Stories with Seth Andrews, has launched. These are roughly 5-minute vignettes that release every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And you can search it on any major podcast app, True Stories with Seth Andrews. Some people have said you just type in my name, Seth Andrews, to find it, and it will pop up. You'll see my face there with a microphone. And every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, you will get a new true story. And it might be, you know, a piece of history that you didn't know about, or it may have been something that happened last week. It could be obscure trivia, weird news, true crime, or some fact about something that we do or use every single day. Just random, cool, true stuff. And the whole format is based on a broadcaster that inspired me back in my old radio days. He was an ABC News broadcaster and storyteller. His name is Paul Harvey. And Paul used to do this feature. It was called The Rest of the Story. And he would take you on a journey, and then at the end of his story, he would throw out a detail or a tidbit that would kind of pull the rug out from underneath you and really make you smile or nod your head or just go, wow. And so my stories are formatted a little bit like that. I mean, there won't be a surprise in every show. Sometimes you're going to see it coming, but it's still really interesting stuff. I don't want to be Paul Harvey, right? I've spent 30 years developing my own storytelling style. But what's that saying? Why create mediocrity when you can copy genius? And as he died, 15, 17 years ago, I haven't been able to find anybody who's doing this kind of thing. So, subscribe. TrueStoriesPodcast.com is the website. And today, I'm going to play some examples from the new show so you know what you're getting into. Here is example number one. Crank it up. I'm Seth Andrews, and what you're about to hear is a true story. In the history of the United States, there have been four presidential assassinations. Abraham Lincoln in 1865, James Garfield in 1881, William McKinley in 1901, and of course, John F. Kennedy in 1963. The history books also reveal other unsuccessful plots to kill a president, plots against Andrew Jackson, Theodore Roosevelt, Harry S. Truman, and others, thwarted plans, near misses. In fact, it was almost 100 years after this country was founded that we even had a secret service, the law enforcement agency designed to protect our political leaders and their families, as well as foreign visitors to our halls of government. It was a very close call on the 30th of March, 1981. 2 months after the inauguration, President Ronald Reagan was returning to his limousine after a speaking event at the Washington Hilton. That was when a would-be assassin opened fire. The shooter, John Hinckley Jr., fired off a .22 revolver. He wounded a police officer and a Secret Service agent. Press Secretary James Brady struck in the head. He survived. And President Ronald Reagan was hit with a ricochet just under his left arm. The Secret Service sprang to action. Reagan shoved into his limousine by an agent named Jerry Parr, and the limo sped away from the scene. Ronald Reagan wanted to return to the White House. He said, "I'm fine, I'm okay, let's go back to the Oval Office." Jerry Parr insisted otherwise. "No, Mr. President, we are not going to the White House. We are going straight to the hospital." Ronald Reagan started coughing up blood. He was convinced even then he had only bitten his lip, when in fact that bullet had broken a rib and punctured his lung. The motorcade rushed to George Washington University Hospital, where Reagan refused the gurney. He insisted on walking inside. But inside those doors, his breathing became erratic. His legs gave out. He dropped down to a knee. He was obviously in a very bad way. The president was rushed to emergency surgery. He lost half of his blood volume right there on the operating table. And after the surgery, to remove a bullet would develop a severe fever. At that time, even as the American public felt somewhat assured at the visual of Ronald Reagan walking himself casually into the hospital, few would realize how very close President Ronald Reagan had come to death. And almost nobody would know the strange coincidence that likely saved him from bleeding to death inside that limousine when he had been insisting not to go to the hospital, to go instead to the White House. Secret Service agent Jerry Parr had been there demanding otherwise. And it's such a very small, small world. You see, Jerry Parr had been inspired to join the Secret Service back when he was a kid. He was 9 years old. He was watching the 1939 film titled Code of the Secret Service. And at that moment, at the age of nine, the seed had been planted. Jerry Parr joined the Secret Service at the age of 32. He was the oldest rookie in his class. He conducted protective duties on domestic and foreign soil for decades, and he was officially commended by the U.S. Congress for his critical role in saving Reagan's life on that terrible day in 1981. The coincidental thing about Jerry Parr the kid inspired by that 1939 film who grew up to one day save President Ronald Reagan? That 1939 film, Code of the Secret Service, starred Ronald Reagan. And that is a true story.
TrueStoriesPodcast.com.
Okay, that's a story that took us back to 1981. I have another one that actually roots to several decades before. It is one of the first shows that released. It is called The Taming of the Shrew. Let me play it for you here. I'm Seth Andrews, and what you're about to hear is a true story. Bill Bowerman was a track and field coach, and he had a long and impressive career. Over the course of several decades, he trained 31 Olympic athletes, 51 All-Americans, 12 American track and field record holders, 22 NCAA champions, and 16 runners who conquered the 4-minute mile. Bill was a coach at the college level. He spent 24 years at the University of Oregon, and his track and field team had a winning season for 23 out of those 24 years. He was the real thing. But the technology of running shoes several decades ago was not great, and Bill Bowerman was frustrated by it. The shoes are too heavy. What are we going to do? Plus, running tracks like those at the University of Oregon were starting to transition from a natural surface to an artificial surface. So the running shoes would no longer need those metal spikes on the bottom to get traction on the ground. The rubber sole would give traction enough. And so Bill started thinking to himself, if we don't need the metal spikes, we reduce the weight of the shoes. If we reduce the weight, we decrease the stress on the joints and we make our runners faster. And then if we could somehow improve the actual rubber sole, our runners would be faster still. But what would that shoe even look like? Bill was having breakfast with his wife in 1971 when they had a conversation that would change the world. Bill was just talking over breakfast. He was using his wife as a sounding board. What do you think of this? What do you think of that? There must be a solution to the running shoe problem. And the fruit of that early morning conversation over the table with his wife would be introduced to the general public 3 years later in 1974. These new and updated running shoes had rubber soles. They had no spikes, no frills, and they were leaner and faster. And with those new updated shoes, Bill Bowerman co-founded a little startup company. And he sold these leaner, meaner, lighter, faster running shoes to the general public. And those shoes became popular. The company grew so fast and became so diverse, it went beyond running shoes, selling other kinds of shoes, and then shirts and pants and jackets, accessories, sporting equipment, eventually even providing uniforms for professional sports franchises like the NBA. Right now, nobody supplies more athletic shoes to the world. $37 billion in revenue every single year, listed on the Fortune 500, and this Goliath of a company auctioned off in 2019 one of the originals, a legitimate, authentic, 50-year-old 1972 Bill Bowerman-made moon shoe. That sucker went up for sale at Sotheby's auction in 2019, and it sold to a Canadian guy, a capital investor named Miles Nadal. He paid just over $437,000. A world record, the most anybody has ever paid for shoes, specifically Nike shoes. Now, if you've been listening closely, the Nike brand name is probably pretty easy to guess. But here's what you may not realize. What happened when Bill and his wife had been having that early morning conversation across the table back in 1971? How do we make the running shoes lighter and faster and more interactive with the running surface? How do we solve the running shoe problem? And as they were talking, his wife was serving up breakfast, specifically waffles. Waffles that she made from scratch. They came out of a kitchen waffle iron. And looking down at his waffle, Bill Bowerman got his moment of inspiration. He thought to himself, you know, what if I turned the bottom of a running shoe into a waffle? You'd have spaces in the rubber sole, so that reduces the amount of rubber needed, which means you reduce the weight of the shoe, but the waffle pattern would actually be great to give you traction on the running surface. You know, this might actually work. And so he got up from the breakfast table and he ran into his home work area and he grabbed the chemicals needed to make urethane and he brought him into the kitchen and he poured urethane into his waffle iron. And the result was inspired. And it would become one of the many reasons that the company he co-founded, Nike, would become a household name. So, my friends, the next time you look down at the soles of your shoes, just check the pattern. It's certainly changed even more over the past 50 years. But I'll bet you never look at that pattern, that waffle pattern, the same way again. And that is a true story.
TrueStoriesPodcast.com.
If you like what you are hearing, subscribe. Just search for it. You will find it on your podcast app, True Stories with Seth Andrews, or you can go to TrueStoriesPodcast.com. Okay, the next example, let's get in the way, way back machine. This one's called A Private Little War. I'm Seth Andrews, and what you're about to hear is a true story. If humans have demonstrated anything through the eras, we've proven our propensity for war. History's stories are so often war stories, from the days of fists and sticks and stones, to the sword fights of old, to modern-day laser-guided bomb strikes from hundreds, perhaps thousands of miles away. War is always afoot. Well, I want to tell you about a modest little war, if there is such a thing. It began on August the 27th, 1896, between the United Kingdom and a little state called Zanzibar. Late 19th century Zanzibar, a sovereign strip, it lay along the Kenyan coast under British rule. And that tiny strip of land, 10 miles long. Imagine a state you could walk across in 3 hours. Zanzibar. Now remember, this little state was under British rule, and then the Sultan of Zanzibar died, and his nephew jumped in and declared himself the new and independent ruler. Now, this was supposed to be Britain's call. Britain would determine who the new Sultan would be. Britain protested to the nephew and said, "No, you cannot do this. Zanzibar belongs to us. Only we decide who gets to be in charge. These are the terms of our treaty." But the nephew, his name was Khalid bin Bargash, would not relinquish the throne. He had taken the seat from his uncle. He would not give it up. So instead of backing down, he doubled down. Khalid barricaded himself behind the palace walls, and then he activated the military 2,800 guards with orders to surround and defend the palace. The British didn't budge. They responded with an ultimatum. Backed by military force, 3 cruisers, 2 gunboats, 150 sailors, and 900 soldiers mustered in the nearby harbor. But Khalid, this new and self-appointed sultan, stood defiant. So he rallied his artillery, Maxim guns, a Gatling gun, a 17th century bronze cannon, and 2 12-pounder field guns, and he pointed them at the British. Tensions were so very, very high. And yet Khalid bin Barghash was convinced that the British were just bluffing. This was all just a show, flexing of muscles, posturing. No way they would ever attack. He called it gunboat diplomacy. There is no way the British will open fire. But then 1 hour later, when negotiations accomplished nothing, the British did open fire. Khalid's artillery was decimated. The Royal Navy attacked the Zanzibari Navy, even sinking its royal yacht. The volleys and the shells and the booms continued until finally Khalid surrendered, standing in the shadow of 500 Zanzibari casualties. And on the day of his surrender, it was, in fact, Britain that installed a new sultan on its own terms. The history books have a name for this war. They call it the Anglo-Zanzibar War. And it is remembered not because people really care about this political squabble over land and who was to play sultan on a 10-mile strip of land 130 years ago. That's not why people remember the Anglo-Zanzibar War. It is remembered for its duration. The American Civil War lasted 4 years, as did World War I. World War II raged on from 1939 to 1945. That's 6 years. The Korean War, 3 years. Vietnam, a full decade. The ancient Roman-Persian Wars ran for almost 7 full centuries. By design, war is a long-term commitment. Or so you might think. You see, the reason that our history books remember that the Anglo-Zanzibar War began on August 27, 1896, is because the war also ended on August 27, 1896. In fact, that hour-long stalemate before the conflict actually lasted longer than the war itself. The British forces fired their first and last shot in a span of 38 minutes. An entire war not played out in a decade, or a year, or a month, a week, even a day, even a single hour, at just over half an hour from beginning to end. The Anglo-Zanzibar War remains the shortest war in history. And that is a true story.
TrueStoriesPodcast.com.
Okay, here's one that's actually scheduled to release later on in the year, like in several months. But because you are here and a member of this audience, you get to hear it way, way, way early. This one's called The Dating Service. I'm Seth Andrews, and what you're about to hear is a true story. Cheryl Bradshaw was looking for love. And isn't that the theme of so many of the stories that we tell? This was in 1978. Cheryl was using a matchmaker to help find a suitable candidate. And that man's name was Rodney Alcala, and he was the man that she picked. He seemed like a good choice. He was intelligent. He had attended UCLA. He certainly passed the background checks. I guess anybody who has ever used a dating service knows the potentials and the potential pitfalls. We think we know someone, but do we just know the idea of someone, their public face, what they want us to see as opposed to who they really are? What surprises lurk just beyond those photographs and videos and biographies and profiles? In the dating scene, like so many other scenes, job interviews, loan applications, and dating services, we want our best face forward. Well, Cheryl had asked a few questions about Rodney, and she liked the answers, and then she would go on to meet him in person. And he wasted no time. He invited her to what he called a date she would never forget. But Cheryl saw his face when he said the words. She noticed that attractive face had a disconcerting, creepy expression upon it. She noticed that he was looking at the floor, never directly at her. There was a strangeness in his voice, in his cadence, the way he spoke. She watched his body language. Something wasn't quite right. And Cheryl started to feel sick, like her body was giving her a message. This whole scenario seemed to be affecting her in a negative way. She didn't feel any attraction. Instead, she felt a tremendous impulse to just escape, to get away. Cheryl quickly turned down Rodney's offer. Then she turned her back and left the room, telling herself she never wanted to see Rodney ever again. And oh, how close Cheryl Bradshaw had come to calamity. Oh, if she had known at the time how her intuition and her instincts almost certainly saved her life. You see, that dating service never actually did a background check on Rodney Alcala. If they'd done so, they would have found a convicted felon who had done 3 years prison time for child rape and assault. A man who would go on to be listed on the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives list before he was finally captured. A man who around that time, unbeknownst to everyone else, had committed at least 4 murders. Several of his would-be victims would escape his strangling hands to tell their tale to the authorities, sending Rodney on the run from the law. His MO had been to lure people into his apartment, and that is where the assaults and killings would commence. Rodney would ultimately come to declare that he himself had murdered 50 to 100 people. Now imagine Rodney Alcala, after he had done 3 years of prison time, but before anybody knew he was a killer, he is seen as an eligible candidate at the dating service, saying these specific words to Cheryl Bradshaw, and he said them on tape. They're a matter of record. He said, "The best time is at night." Spoken in the voice of a killer, those words are chilling. Rodney died in prison. In fact, he died awaiting execution on death row back in 2021. He was 77 at the time. And here's the really interesting part. Cheryl had not met Rodney Alcala on just any dating service. These two met as contestants on a game show broadcast to the whole country. The nation saw this encounter, saw their faces, heard their voices, their very first meeting. And like Cheryl Bradshaw, that television audience was unknowingly introduced to a serial killer. The killer that Cheryl met with suspicion and then left behind, saving her own life backstage on the hugely popular TV show, The Dating Game. And Rodney Alcala would become forever known as the Dating Game Killer.
Bachelor number one.
Yes?
What's your best time?
The best time is at night, nighttime.
Why do you say that?
Because that's the only time there is.
And that story, the story of Cheryl Bradshaw's interview with death, is a true story.
TrueStoriesPodcast.com.
Okay, let's do one more. I don't want to leave you with the serial killer story, so let's do something that's a little bit lighter. Again, this is going to air, I think, a few months down the pipe on the actual show page on the podcast app, but you get it early. This one's called The Lock-In. I'm Seth Andrews, and what you're about to hear is a true story. April 4th, 1968. Sam Leroy was at a liquor store buying beer when the news came in over the TV. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had been shot in Memphis. Standing there in the store, Sam asked the question, "Is he dead?" And the reply came back, "Not yet." The news of Dr. King's death would come later on that evening, and Sam was devastated. At the time, he was a sophomore at Morehouse College in Atlanta, and one of three of Martin Luther King Jr.'s memorial services would be held there, and they needed volunteers, people to help the attendees find their way around campus. Sam volunteered to help out. He had met Dr. King years before, just in passing, and as it had struck the hearts of so many millions of people like a kick in the chest, this murder felt personal. But Sam had been there at the memorial service. He had actually seen Dr. King lying in state at Sisters Chapel, and it deeply affected him. He wasn't a political guy, at least not before all of this. There hadn't been very many civil rights protests where he grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It was not until his first year of college in 1966 that he first started meeting the men coming back from the conflict in Vietnam. And those weary, worn student soldiers warned him. They said the draft, the war, the meat grinder might soon come for him. Sam Leroy's cousin was killed in the Vietnam War that very next year. It seemed like the entire world was closing in. Sam began to get introspective. He took a closer look at his own university. Morehouse was selling a largely white American dream narrative. No focus on ethnic studies, no focus on civil rights. The school board operated far away from the student body. There was a total disconnect. But Sam wanted things to change, especially for black students to be acknowledged and recognized by the Morehouse College School Board. He wanted to talk about important things, the war, the country, the culture. He said, "Meet with us, talk with us, connect with us." He petitioned the school board, and he was refused. And then somebody on campus said this. They said, "Here's an idea. During one of the school board meetings, let's lock everybody inside the room, and we don't let them out. Yeah, it's going to be trouble. Yes, it's probably illegal, but we'll be making a statement. We'll be saying, you cannot ignore us. Lock them in. Let's just lock them in." And that's exactly what they did on a fateful day during Sam's junior year in 1969. The board members panicked. They pleaded with the students, "Please let us out." Hours passed. Negotiations took place. Sam and his fellow activist students outside the door saying, "We want this. We want you to do that. We want to be acknowledged for this reason in this way." And finally, after enough time had passed, they offered up this condition. They said, "If we let you out, the school board cannot expel us." And after a full day and a half, the school board agreed. And when these people got out of the room, Sam and his accomplices were, in fact, expelled. They'd taken hostages inside their own college, and they had paid the heavy price. All of this sort of internal awakening, the national unrest, the death of his cousin, all of this galvanized him into activism. He joined anti-war protests at the height of the Vietnam War, and even though he had started with nonviolent civil disobedience as protest, he worried about revolution coming to the United States, a racial war, a political war, a culture war, establishment versus anti-establishment. At one point, he even started buying firearms in expectation of the chaos to come. By the summer of 1969, Sam was on the radar of the FBI. They actually showed up at his mother's house, and they pleaded with her, "Get your son out of Atlanta. He's going to get caught up in something that just might get him killed." And so Sam's mother drove him to the airport and sent him off to live with his aunt in Los Angeles, California. Sam continued college life. He majored in marine biology, then architecture. But his college interests began to shift to public speaking and the arts, specifically drama. Drama was going to become his outlet. Drama would be his activism, a way to interact with and perhaps even influence the country and the world. Sam took the stage for several plays. Those parts led to a few tiny roles in TV films, then a move to New York City in 1976, 10 more years of stage acting. It wasn't until 1988 that lightning began to strike in the life of Sam Leroy. Sam got two bit parts in two Spike Lee movies and a chance to work with the great Martin Scorsese in 1990. After years of struggling with addiction to heroin and cocaine, Sam Leroy went to rehab and he got clean, ready for what would become the rest of his life, 3 decades plus, as a known face on the big screen and a household name. From Jurassic Park to A Time to Kill to Pulp Fiction to Deep Blue Sea, even a role in Star Wars, Sam was offered his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in 2000, and he remains a popular movie star today. By now, you have finally been properly introduced to the rowdy, audacious, activist college kid so intent on being heard that he once held his own school board hostage for 36 hours. But ultimately becoming an icon for action and activism on the big screen, more than 150 films that have grossed more than $27 billion worldwide. Sam Leroy Jackson. Samuel L. Jackson. A man who remains his own unique brand of rebel today. And that's a true story.
TrueStoriesPodcast.com.
Isn't that fun? I mean, that is just, they're great stories to tell. It's enjoyable for me as the storyteller. And I think, you know, beyond this sort of second venture, it'll help me keep things fresh for you at The Thinking Atheist. Anyway, you can search for it, Seth Andrews True Stories. You can go to the website, TrueStoriesPodcast.com. Thanks so much for your support. Help me get the word out. And of course, I will see you back here next week as we continue to do The Thinking Atheist Podcast. And I'll see you then.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring the Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah. Oh. Sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino.
Chumba. That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.